Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. Today we're here to discuss season two of one of our favorite costume dramas, The Gilded Age. We're excited to track all the drama between Team New Money and Team Old Money as they fight over power for New York City's high society at the end of the 19th century. I'm Andrea.
And I'm Paul. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, we are cousins who love to explore fantasy and sci-fi stories. Last year, we expanded our coverage to discuss our favorite period pieces. We kicked off that coverage discussing the Gilded Age, and so we're back to discuss Julian Fellowes' newest project with more in-depth analysis. And you can find the episodes on Downton Abbey, Bridgerton, Outlander, The Crown, and your podcast feeds.
We're very excited to spend each week catching up with the Russells, Van Ryans, and all the rich characters, and I mean that literally and figuratively. This week, the battle between Turner, and that's what I'll be calling her, not Mrs. Winterton, Turner, okay? That's her name. And Mrs. Russell continues while Peggy and Mr. Fortune arrive in the South. Meanwhile, the romance between Aunt Ada and Mr. Forte heats up and leads to a marriage proposal. Shocking.
Well, you know what? While Aunt Ada and Mr. Forte prefer late-night discussion of missionary charities, young Larry Russell and Mrs. Blaine prefer early morning conversations after missionaries. And we're here for it all. Kinfolk Lore will have adult content, and unlike Bertha Russell, we won't invite you all this way to flame you and then leave you empty-handed.
That was wild.
Wild.
I love her.
She said, you've had your fun. You've had your fun. Like, what are you doing?
It was great. Someone had to say it. All right. So let's talk the summary. So this week, with Team New Money, Mrs. Russell gives a tour of the new Metropolitan Opera to potential patrons and learns two unsettling things. First, that the Met is broke. Because they're behind schedule in selling leases to boxes. And second, that a Rhode Island newspaper has published a blind item about Larry and Mrs. Blaine.
And then Aurora Fane with the, I didn't want to say this, but at the play the other day with Oscar Wilde, you know, and she's always that friend who's like, I got the tea that I've been holding out on giving you until you got blindsided. Aurora Fane.
Yeah, like you should have mentioned it before.
Yeah, 100%.
Mrs. Russell summons Mrs. Blaine to visit her in New York and lays it out real plainly. End the relationship because there's no future in it.
Yeah.
Due to Mr. Russell's efforts, they found their way in with the Duke of Buckingham and are invited to a reception for him. At the reception, Mrs. Russell changes place cards. This is wild stuff. So that she can charm him and puts Turner next to Oscar Van Ryn.
Something about needing to get out of the doghouse will make you do some crazy shit. Like, Mr. Russell is out here. He's pulling all the strings, yo. This is hilarious.
I was very impressed. Yeah. Like, super impressed. I was like, okay, all right. She said, you can get back in my good graces if you pull this off. And he said, bet. I'm about to do it.
These lonely luncheons are not suiting me these days.
God forbid you have to eat a meal by himself.
I know.
After she changes the place cards, Turner ends up next to Oscar. And, you know, that was interesting because those two, I have also questions. What was Oscar even doing?
Yo, Oscar like Caesar. He's like, oh, it's you. His response was wild. And yes, why the fuck is he at this dinner? Like, how did he get the invite?
I don't understand why him and Maude Beaton are there, but whatever. Like, Julian Fellowes needed them to be there. Yeah. Like, that's why they're there. So Mrs. Russell then invites the Duke to not stay, right? He already has plans to stay with the Wintertons in Newport, but instead to stay with the Russells instead. And I, like, I'm just like, wow, the savagery of this woman. Like, she just stole their house guests from them.
She's like, she won't mind. She's fine.
It'll be fine. I'll hold a dinner and I'll invite them. It's fine. So meanwhile, it seems that someone has let it slip to Mrs. Astor that Turner is the former lady's maid of Mrs. Russell.
So we got some suspects on this one. We're going to hold out and kind of see.
I wonder who would have let that slip.
I don't know. I mean, like,
since there's like not that many people who know.
Yeah, exactly. We know it ain't Oscar because Oscar's at the dinner and he ain't saying nothing. You know what I mean? So he's out with, well, I guess he's still in with the Astors. He's still in with the Astors. So
yeah, no, he's good with the Astors.
Yeah.
Mr. Winterton is summoned by Mrs. Astor and asked to surrender his box at the academy. Angrily, he tells her that, sure, he'll leave. That's fine. But he's going to take his friends with him. Now, I have to say, I didn't have any feelings about Mr. Winterton until this scene. And I was like, I like him.
Yeah. No, he was like,
I like him.
I will not forget this.
Yeah. He like openly threatened Mrs. Astor and had no problem with it. Yeah, I was like, okay. Good on Mr. Winterton.
Yeah, he's not for the games. Not for the games.
Watson goes back to Robert McNeil and tells him that he needs to hear from Flora that she wants him to move to the West Coast.
Thank you. Can we get the daughter to actually say this? I'm with this. I love this movement.
And finally, in a scene that was heartbreaking, despite the fact that I've been waiting for this scene for 2 episodes.
The beginning.
Mrs. Blaine breaks up with Larry and sends him and his workmen packing. So he lost his love and his job. Maybe be a little bit more discreet next time, Larry.
Oh, my guy's out here. My guy's out here heavy in his cups, though. He's in his cups, heavy. He's, oh my gosh. Yo, that's wild. I felt it was sad to see happen, even though we wanted it to happen. Like, we're on the record. We don't want this. This was not the one. This was not it.
Okay. I found this scene heartbreaking, but yeah. I'm still glad it happened.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. Agreed. 100%. So the flirtation between Oscar and Maude Beaton seems to be warming up as well. Oscar is giving her some financial advice and escorting her around town. He's like, you know, he's getting really serious about this. It seems like they're starting to link up. They seem evenly matched. Marion attends the mother-daughter tea with Frances, and apparently her performance as a teacher is so regarded that she's asked to take on a charity class. More on this later. and the other students like love her so much that they say she's her favorite teacher. She gets ran up on by a parent. You know, and let's just be honest. Let's just be honest out here. You know, Frances is out here parent trapping. It's happening. We can. Mm-hmm. She's like, look at us, the three of us. We're a family. I mean,
awkward.
Yes, super duper awkward. Peggy and Mr. Fortune arrive in Tuskegee. They, you know, Peggy and him took the train. They're on their own. And they're surprised by the good relationship that Booker T. Washington has with the white people down in the South. Mr. Fortune and Mr. Washington have very different views about improving the conditions for black people and spar at the dinner table over these opposing views. Probably not the best time to like hold these kind of, I mean, like you're in another person's home. They went through all this trouble. They're hosting you. They want you right. It's kind of wild. I don't know. I thought it was a lot of pocket.
I didn't think he was rude, but I did think that he was judgmental.
Yeah.
You know, it was, I don't know. It felt, Mr. Fortune feels like he's not on great footing here, but you know, both their worldviews are valid in this moment.
100%. I definitely they're both valid views. Just the timing of it for sure I was thinking about. And then speaking of timing, Jack is making progress on his alarm clock. Team O Money, it seems he's figured out what's made it stop working. I love this part. This is like one of my favorite storylines in this season, honestly.
I like it too, but I also thought it was hilarious when it went off in the middle of dinner. Agnes was like scandalized. It's like this woman's dinners are being so disrupted. Like, you know, you got well, meals, I should say. You got the soup at luncheon, an alarm clock going off, a bee. Like, it's just, it's a lot.
It's a lot going on. And all these, the strange flowers from, you know, they're with the bee. That's weird. It's weird. You're right. She'll be all right. She'll be all right. She's tough. And the flirtation between Mr. Forte and Ada heats up over the course of the episode. First, she and Agnes host a gathering so he can recruit donors for the missionary work. Then he takes her for a stroll in the park. And finally, after asking her to attend the opera with him at a night at church, he gets down on one knee and proposes. And Aunt Ada accepts him immediately. What a scene.
Love it. Love it.
Absolutely love it. Oh my gosh. Let's so much to unpack in this. Let's get right into it. I mean, the strike's on the horizon. Mr. Russell intends to bring scabs into work. He's warned that there may be some armed conflict. What the fuck is happening?
I want to just say, can we just have the strike already? I'm tired of talking about the strike. Can we just have a strike? Like, the strike has been building since episode one. Let's just strike. Let's do it.
You know that's how Julian Fellows gets down. You know this how he rolls. Remember when Sybil was going to the protest and they had all this lead up to the to the protest, and then, you know, they it was crazy. It was nuts. It was super duper nuts. Yeah. But yeah, I'm ready for the strike too. I really am. I think that, like, we had all the conversation in the last episode around it all. It's time now. The stage has been set. It's time. It's just time to go.
I think this conversation at the end of the episode is meant to give us, like, the stakes, right? Like,
yeah,
we're not just talking like a like strike where people are on the picket line. We're talking that, you know, he's spoken to the governor about having, I guess, the National Guard or whatever the equivalent is there. And, you know, everyone else is telling him, like, the strikers are not just going to let the scabbers, like, go to work. Like, they're going to try to stop them with force if possible. So I hope he's ready for that, because it's like these things can and will become very violent.
Yeah, it's super wild. Super wild that we're here. I mean, he's got to, like, really think about what he's doing here.
And it's so tough to see Mr. Russell, like, complaining about the basic ask of his workers when he lives in this massive house. It took up an entire corner on Fifth Avenue and has a building with his name on it. You know, like, what are you doing, my guy?
It's super wild. I mean, and we're just talking about, like, worker safety and, like, you know, like time away. Like, it's kind of nuts. These are things that we kind of, you know, just take, like, they should happen. But, like, man, the fights that had to go for those things, man, maybe we need some new protest. I would love, let's, I hear a lot of times people talk about this 4-day work week. Let's make it happen. Let's go. Come on.
I will be right there on the picket line.
I'll be right there. Right there. Let's roll. Oh, man. And, you know, we, again, are being robbed of the romance we want. But there's a lot of romance that happens in this episode. We are not seeing the romance we're looking for. But let's talk about Ada and Mr. Forte.
I love it. Excuse me. I love this because... Yeah. One thing you can say for Julian Fellows is that, unlike, we talked about this a lot when we were covering Queen Charlotte, often period pieces are focused on the younger generation. Mm-hmm. And I think we also talked about this in Outlander, right? Mm-hmm. That, like, that is just sort of the way these books, which most period pieces are adapted off of books, were adapted, which is, like, you focus on the younger generation and the marriage plot, them getting married, what the stakes are, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But what I really enjoy about this show, and what I did also enjoy about Downton Abbey, is that middle age love is not only seen as possible, but it's seen as it can be its own plot line that is has its own complications. And I just really love that Ada and Mr. Forte are, their courtship is laid out for us. Like, first of all, this is the most time we spent with Aunt Ada. Like, she was a pretty minor character in season one, even though she was an important character. Mm-hmm. And I think we even said when we covered it that we'd like to see more from her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love that she gets her own love story. You know, it shows kind of like the tentative way that they had to go about it because of Agnes. And it's just really cute, right? And it kind of reminded me of the romance between Mrs. Hughes and Carson, mm-hmm. which was like slowly building from like season one or two of Downton Abbey. Like, you could kind of see these moments where they were not just confidence, but like where something may have been bubbling.
Mm-hmm.
And also Isabel Crawley and Lord Merton in the later seasons of Downton Abbey, where you get this like, will they, won't they? Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that Julian Fellowes doesn't just focus on the Marians, the Gladyses, the Larrys, but is also putting in here like that people, sometimes it takes them longer to find love. Yeah. That it doesn't, love doesn't naturally just coincide with you for everyone. And so I love this romance and I'm really happy for Ada.
Yeah, I agree. I loved it. I loved every part of it. And it was just, it's been so, so rewarding this whole season, because you can kind of feel it in the first episode that she was like, you know, trying to get his attention to come over and talk to them. And now to see it culminate here, it's really, really awesome. You know, it also puts me in the mind of different, obviously, storyline, writer, genre, the whole thing. But it reminds me of what we talked about a little bit too when we covered Lovecraft with Hippolyta and Uncle George, how like that whole same kind of thing, mm-hmm. like where like, you know, these relationships that aren't the you know, like you said, the youthful traditional marriage plot relationships, but they still have depth and they have gravity and they have, you know, there's a lot to them, and I love it. It's really awesome. I also like Bourdon and Mrs. Bruce's little bubbling thing.
I like that you're using his French name.
I know. I use the French name even though he's from Kentucky. I mean, you know, I mean, it's a little bit of a troll. I get it, but I'm just saying. I do like this thing that's brewing with them. He asked her to go to a concert while she's like admiring the piano. This is really cute.
Yeah, I'm all about it. I was like, say yes, say yes, say yes.
I like it. You know, so that's also, I'm out on the whole Dashiell Marion thing, although Frances is pressing. She's all about it.
I'm only out on it because I want Marion to be with Larry. Like, that's my main reason for being out on it. I don't really have a problem with Dashiell. He seems like a nice enough guy. It does seem like he's looking more for a mom than a wife, but
yes.
I think given what we know about what marriage could be like during this period, I don't think that he would be unkind or a bad husband. I just don't think that, first of all, I don't think that Marion's focused on love at all. I think Mr. Rakes pretty much put that to bed for her.
Yeah.
But secondly, I just would, if Marion's going to be with someone, I prefer it to be with Larry. And my reasons for wanting Marion and Larry together are not because it just works and it would bridge the old money and the new money. It's more because both of them have these kind of unconventional approaches to life. Like, they both want to do something different. Like, Larry, even going into architecture, that's not what his dad wanted him to do.
Mm-hmm.
But he, after he spoke to Marion last season, he decided that it was worth pursuing what he wanted to do. He's being a little bit reckless right now, but I really appreciate that, like, the both of them are kind of unconventional. They're different. They're not just falling into the societal norms that have been carved out for them. And so I think they would make a really good couple, and they're friends. Like, the basis of any good relationship should be friendship. So yeah. I'm hoping that these two eventually link up. So the Dashiell thing and the Mrs. Blaine thing just annoy me, because I just want Marion and Larry to get together. I'm shipping them.
Yeah. I mean, it's also like the chemistry that pops off the screen between these two. And like you said, like when you just were describing what you love about them, you said, you know, like Larry wants to be an architect and Marion like encouraged him. And similar for her, like when there's things that are going on for her, he encourages her to like do what she's setting out to do. And I just think like that just feels like something, you know what I mean? And so, I mean, here's the thing though. This is the only criticism I have, like more meta, is when you can see the strings, right? And the reality of it is that Larry had to have this. Larry could not be the career focused, good son, everything going well, and then we get right to him and Marion getting together. It couldn't happen. Like, there had to be like something that he could take an L in, because she already took an L before. Like, it was like this whole thing with Mr. Rakes was like a big, like, damn, this one hurt, right? So, like, this is just normal in all these shows. Like, somebody's gonna, this is just the normal tact. I just knew this was gonna have to happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is Larry's Lavinia Squire.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Exactly.
Who, like, the Downton Abbey fandom hated Lavinia for no reason. Yeah. Like, Lavinia is like a very sweet character. She's super smart. She's like very devoted to Matthew, and we were just like, you're not Lady Mary, so you're dead to us.
Nobody wanted Lavinia. Like, no, yes, I'm with you 110%. This is Geneva Dusaney. Like, let's get her up out of here.
Oh god. Poor Geneva.
Yeah, like the only thing is, I don't think they're gonna do this actress like this, so I know that something's gonna happen. That's why I keep thinking in my brain, I'm like, yo, I feel like the right pairing for these two is Mrs. Blaine and Dashiell. I don't know why, but I just feel it. I haven't seen, I just want that. I kind of want that.
Oh, I don't want that at all.
No?
No. Mrs. Blaine is not interested in being tied down and having a stepkid. Like, she's trying to live her life.
Yeah, I guess that's fair. She did have to deal with, like, old dude forever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I think she's just, like, trying to, like, find joy and live her life. And in this case, it was reckless, right? Like, she should have never let it get to the point where they're saying love, right?
Yeah.
But I think she's just trying to, like, find herself after she's been tied down to this marriage that was not happy for her for so long. And so I don't see Dashiell's looking for something else. And I also just think, like, you know, it seems like Francis and Dashiell's, like, Francis's mom didn't die that long ago. So I think there's some mourning that's still happening. But yeah, I would prefer if there was like an unmarried version of Aurora Fane, you know, around, that might be a better match for Dashiell.
Yeah, we're not messing with Mr. Morgan for Mrs. Blaine either. Mr. Morgan can kick rocks. Get him up out of here. All right.
I already forgot about Mr. Morgan.
Exactly. Yeah, he's forgettable for sure. Yeah, I mean, I hear you. I also, God, man, I don't know, man. I mean, Mrs. Blaine gets so, this is just brutal for her this episode. I did feel bad for her. I'm not going to lie. Like, when freaking Bertha's like, when he's hitting the, what do you want? When he's hitting the prime of his life, you'll be like on a walker, like 1 foot in the grave, basically. I was like, damn. Sorry. But you know what that's like with your husband. I was like, yo, she's wild. Bertha held nothing back.
Yeah, this is the lesson for anybody who's thinking of courting either of the Russell children. If it doesn't work out in your favor, one of the parents is going to read you for filth.
Yeah, 100%.
Because this took me back to, like, Mr. Russell telling Oscar to kick rocks. Like, it was brutal. It had to be said, though, because I really do think that Larry's not really thinking through the long-term implications of the relationship. And and we've talked at length about how the way their society is set up is detrimental for both men and women. Larry is the only son of the Russells. Like, his responsibility is to kind of carry on their legacy. And so I don't see how that would have happened with Mrs. Blaine.
No, I agree. I totally agree. And, you know, and for Mrs. Blaine, like, she runs a real risk. It's already in the papers. I mean, they already got, like, Page Six out here in these streets, like, in New York City. Like, you know, like, it's, the Post is already popping. I don't know what to say. Like, it would close a lot of doors for her in society, and he would be fine, but she would not. And I think it's a risk that is very one-sided. And I think, you know, in some ways, what Bertha's saying is kind of like, you know, you've had your fun. Like, I get it. Like, you know, you needed this. Like, that's cool. But, like, this is getting out of hand now. We got to stop it. You know what I mean? Like, so I just feel like that's, you know, tough for Larry. You could tell he doesn't take it well. You got to get him back to, I guess we got to get him back into the city so he can clear his head. You know what I mean? Like, that's basically what it has to come down to. We got to do that sooner than later.
Yeah, totally.
Let's talk about Marion's new assignment and Agnes's take on this.
When does it begin teaching these beggars?
It's so savage. Oh my God.
She is like the worst kind of snob. I don't know why I like Agnes.
I don't either.
She's so awful. She's so awful. We have like a bunch of stuff in the We Googled That For You section today, but like I noticed that when the principal offered her this position, she name dropped Jane Addams, which was kind of dope. I was like, okay, mm-hmm. we're really covering the social justice period of the Gilded Age. But I will say that Agnes's whole response to this, like, Agnes is just the worst. Like, she's just the worst. Oh, Marion is so upset when she calls them beggars. Please don't call them that. And I just don't understand, like, who could be against? First of all, also, Agnes is, like, really down with charity.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like, why she's against people who haven't had appropriate education getting it. Like, it's just
I don't think that's how I read this. She's not against that. She's against, like, Marion doing it while she's on her payroll. Like, she's like, no, I need you to fucking get off my payroll. Like, this is not cheap. These dresses.
She's like, I need you to marry Dashiell, like, immediately.
Yeah. Like, yeah, you're doing all this all this extracurricular shit. Like, I need you focus, man. Get these dresses are not cheap. Anyway, you have adapted and taken in this New York fashion life in a way that I did not anticipate. Okay.
It's true. Marion had a real glow up. Actually, everyone had a glow up because some of Ida's dresses this season, I'm like, wow, everybody's just looking their very best.
100%. It's crazy.
And poor Mrs. Van Ryn is footing the bill for all of it.
Every last penny. She's like, fuck this moving furniture and voluntary to teach these beggars. All right, let's go. I can't believe she called them beggars. It hurt. It really hurt. I was like, yo. And the only reason we like her is because she gives us, it's so funny. If you're watching this and you're not a Downton fan, you may have a different response. I would love to do a poll. She just gives us dowager vibes. Like, we just can't help it. We're just like, okay, she's like a meaner, sterner dowager countess.
She is 10 times meaner than the dowager who seemed to be like super mean on Downton Abbey. Like, but she's much meaner.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. Oh man. So that's also like, I mean, like the big part of this episode was Mr. Fortune and Peggy going down to the South. So what were your thoughts of, like, you know, the argument between Mr. Thomas Fortune and Booker T. Washington?
So It's interesting because I've never had to consider Booker T. Washington's views in the context of which Booker T. Washington lived, right? I've always lived in a post-slavery society where I could look at the views of Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois and all of these other thought leaders, and with the hindsight of being like, who was right and who was wrong. So what I enjoyed about the argument that they're having here is that Mr. Fortune is voicing an opinion that I think most viewers can respect and validate immediately, which is that, like, it shouldn't just be about taking whatever leftovers white society is handing down to you, that, like, the fight for equality means fighting for equality. It means fighting for jobs that are done by white people, not just the ones they don't want. It means fighting for education. It means opportunities and trying to build prosperity. But this conversation really puts us in the position of Booker T. and Fannie Washington, who are both like, yeah, but we have to live here with these violent, crazy white people. And I don't mean all white people were like that, but like with the violent and crazy ones, like he's very specific. Like, I don't work with those folks. Right. I work with the folks who are not trying to murder us, but you can't ignore that there are those who don't think of us as human, as Dorothy Scott said, and standing up for our rights comes with a cost. Saying that we are equal to white people comes with a cost. So in the meantime, what are we supposed to do? Like, he's still working to the advancement of Black people, but in incremental ways. And I think that, like, I was raised in a household where that largely, like, dismissed him. Like, no, he was wrong, right? But if you think about it in his experience, it seems like a totally valid point of view. These people were living under the threat of violence, lynching, extreme poverty. Like, there's only so much you can do when the boot is still going to stay on your neck. And like, Mr. Fortune at the end of the day can get on a train and go back to New York City, right? What are the Black folks who can't leave supposed to do?
Yeah, and I thought it was very, very interesting the way they had them take the different positions because of what we said in an earlier episode about Mr. Fortune and how progressive his stances were for his time period. And yeah, I mean, like, do we disagree with his takes? No, but I think that where my thing was on the timing was like, you know, here you are. It's like an accomplishment for this family and the community to have this school in a place where they're going to be able to build on the trades, right? Like, to build these things that they're doing. It may be not the right time to, like, push your philosophy from a northern perspective. You know what I mean? Like, it's like the time to celebrate them for their win. And then, you know, obviously he's trying to keep balance to what, you know, what the perspective is. But I just think, like, man, like you said, there's no, he's not going to have to get, he's going to get on his train and go home. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I think you're totally right that, like, his criticism falls a little bit on deaf ears here because it's like, okay, but you won't even be here with us. Like,
yeah,
we're in this struggle down here that you don't even have to deal with. Like, here's this young reporter you brought with you. And Fannie Washington makes the point of, like, the girls who she's teaching are totally capable, but it's like a thing they can't even dream of.
Yeah.
Is being a woman reporter, being able to kind of move freely, to write, to have your, to share your opinion. Like, that's not even something they can consider.
And when you're dealing with, like, oppressed classes of people, of which there are many of us in this world, when you look at this stuff, you often see this schism of, like, the philosophies going back and forth against each other instead of realizing that they're just opposite tracks to the same destination, right? Like, mm-hmm. And I really feel like there's room to like find common ground in this that Mr. Fortune missed an opportunity on. And I don't think that I think part of the reason why he invited him was to get to the point of like, hey, let's let people up north know what we're doing down here. And that is not in the sense of like spreading propaganda, but just like in the sense of like, hey, it's not a lost cause. You know what I mean? Like, and I thought that was important. So,
right. I mean, I think Mr. Fortune has credibility because he too is a former enslaved person.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So it's not like he's a person who's never experienced mm-hmm. bondage. Right. But I also think that he's far enough removed that he has a relative safety in his day to day. Mm-hmm. That he not has forgotten, but is just like not experiencing the brutality of post-Civil War South. Like the Reconstruction era was an era mm-hmm. of great progress, but it was also an era of great violence. Mm-hmm. The Klan was born out of it as we know it today. Like this was a time period where there was still a lot of resentment about what had happened in the war, but also like the raw economics of what ending enslavement did changed the lives of hundreds of thousands of white people, and they're not okay with it, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this struggle lasts into the middle of the next century and in some ways still persists today. So I thought it was an interesting conversation. And I think it is one thing that I had initially when I first saw it wondered about, like, would these two men have engaged in this back and forth? And I think that this is actually quite true to both of their characters. So yeah. Hats off to the fellows in the writing team.
I agree.
For putting these two in a room together and then expressing their ideals in a way that I think is quite truthful. I'm not sure, and maybe I should have looked this up, if they ever actually met. Like this, right? I'm not sure, but like I'm all for having this conversation on the show because I think it's an important one.
Yeah, me too. I think it was an important thing for them to show the two different viewpoints, and it looks like he was actually a advisor to Booker T. Washington. Actually an advisor to Booker T. Washington. Yeah. So I just looked it up and that's cool. I mean, like, and they had different, I mean, you know, sometimes your mentors and your advisors, you don't necessarily agree with. Mm-hmm. That's it. That is what it is. And then there, let's get back into the Russell makeup sesh that is currently happening based on Mr. Russell coming through. She made him work for that forgiveness.
Good on her.
Yeah, she made him work for that. She was like, you know what, look, you're gonna have to get me a Duke. You want you got to give me a Duke. All right, this is what it's coming down to.
I like how this whole construction of this episode is could have the title that the first season of Bridgerton could have, mm-hmm. The Duke and Me.
Oh man. And yeah, because you know it really riled up another character, Mrs. Bridgerton.
I don't want the Bridgerton stands coming for me. The name of the first Bridgerton book is The Duke and I. Sorry for my bad English.
The Bridgerton crew they'll be like, yo, whoa, listen, period piece, folks, calm down. But Mrs. Russell wants the Duke, but it was someone else's Duke, and this person lets us know she has a complete fucking meltdown at the end of this episode. I don't want other Dukes. I want this Duke. He's mine, and she took him from me.
It's so hysterical. Let me just say, I don't know if this is an intentional setup, but I love Mr. Winterton by the end of this episode.
Yeah.
Because first of all, he waits until after the whole thing with the dinner with the Duke to tell her that they lost their box at the Academy. The same box that she's been gloating over, you know, from her first appearance, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when she's like, oh yeah, I was a companion, I told you, and he's like, maybe you did. I'm like, dude, you know she didn't tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
But he totally believes her bull story about being Mrs. Russell's companion, which I would have had so many questions about, but he's like, whatever, I don't really care that
mm-hmm,
much.
Mm-hmm.
I also think this would have been a perfect opportunity for Turner to come clean about it and just tell him, because I think now she's actually lied to his face.
I don't know, man. Mr. Winterton does not look like a person that suffers fools. He just gave it to Mrs. Astor like super duper fat. He may be like, look, you try to play me? Like he seems like nice, but I don't know. I don't think Turner played that wrong. I think you're right. She could have come clean, but we don't know the outcome of that. That could have been the end of the whole game for her.
Yeah, I mean, I have questions about this whole union, because even in the previous episode, when the downstairs staff at the Russell House was talking about how this even happened, how did Turner end up as Mrs. Winterton,
mm-hmm.
I did not buy the story that footman shared, which I don't know his name, I apologize, but which was basically like she wrote him a letter and, you know, one thing led to the next. And I was like, so he didn't do any background on this woman? Like, he didn't meet her family? He didn't, like, I don't quite understand how they went from a letter writing into marriage, but whatever. Okay, Mr. Winterton clearly saw her, was impressed, thought she's beautiful. And let's be honest, Turner's a looker.
Yeah, especially when you're looking at Mr. Winterton. Mr. Winterton is like, he's probably just like, you know, old dude. Like, he's like, yeah, for sure, definitely. I mean,
yeah, I think we're supposed to understand he's a widower. I think that we learned that in episode one, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Anyway, listen. I still think that when you've been caught in a lie once, it just makes it worse to pile on the lying. And so now apparently she didn't say anything about her past before to him. Now she's actively lied and said she was a companion. It would not surprise. And she's told him that it was for the Russells. It would not surprise me if this came back to bite her later. But when he says, oh, well, Mrs. Russell couldn't have known that Mrs. Astor would have had this reaction, Turner, you know, is like, yes, she couldn't have known. Obviously, she knows Mrs. Russell a lot better than him.
Yeah.
So when she has this total meltdown, one, the fact that he like is like, we'll just get another Duke. Love this dude.
Yeah.
And then she immediately exposes that this whole, her whole upset is because Mrs. Russell is behind it. I'm just like, Turner, this was not the time to have a meltdown. Like, you could have acted more dignified. And then, unlike Mrs. Russell, who will yell at you but then work quietly in the background,
yeah,
like, she needs to, instead of Mrs. Russell learning from Turner in season one, Turner obviously should have been picking up some things from Mrs. Russell.
1,000%. And I think, you know, the Winterton like doesn't even think it's Mrs. Russell that said it. Like, he's probably like, yeah, she probably wouldn't have said it. Like, and then he was like, and then she, even if she did, I'm like, it's kind of crazy that, yeah, he's kind of test. I agree with you. It's going to come back to it, because it kind of felt like a little bit of a temperature check, like, you know what I mean? Like, he was kind of
100%, because he's like, why did she need a companion? She's married.
Yeah, exactly.
I also thought it was weird when she said that she was companion, because, like, I don't know, I don't really understand the role of companions that well, but in the literature that I've read where there's been a companion, it's almost always been an older woman who pays someone to travel with her.
Mm-hmm.
Or a young child who is homebound for whatever reason, like in Heidi. Anyway, I just was a little bit confused about why she thought that was going to work. Because I'm sitting here like, what does she need a companion for? She has two children and a husband.
Yeah, she don't. Man, Turner out here just like, she just burying herself little bit by little bit because she's punching above her fighting weight. You know, it's wait. She should have just, what would have been the best tact is just, all right, I'm going to take this Winterton money, get my box, get a box in both places and buy my time. You know what I mean? But she went all aggressive with it. And, you know, now she's going to take these L's. You're going to take these L's.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe she should have, now that she, Larry, not Larry, sorry. Now that Oscar is back in her orbit, like, those two are much better plotters together than they are separately. So maybe they should have, you know, got the old band back together.
Yeah, 110% that would have helped her. But she moved too aggressively. She was, like, ready to go right away, you know? And, man, listen, she made, like, listen, when my thing is, that's not even smart. You got to know your opponent. Like, when Bertha's making, like, pushing Mrs. Astor, who's like the like person who was running society for all this time, she's pushing her to the limit. How do you feel like you're gonna be the one? You're gonna be the one? Really? Okay, cool.
And I didn't feel like, even though Bertha was upset, obviously, to see Turner's rise, I didn't feel like she came at her sideways, right? Because she needs her. She needs her to buy a box, right? And so she tells her off the bat, I don't intend to make trouble.
Yeah.
And that's when Turner is like, I don't either, but if I were, I would make it this way. Like, come on, man. You asked for this fight and now you lost because you lost your little Duke.
Yeah.
You lost your little box. You're out here in the cold, man.
Mad cold. It's crazy. But you know who else is in the cold? Gladys Russell. Where the hell is Gladys Russell?
Where is Gladys?
Where is Gladys Russell? Like, it's like she's just gone.
She has had so little to do this season. I find it shocking because that first episode was, like, very heavily about her. I thought this was going to be Gladys's coming out season, right? The last season ended with her coming out ball. Now she has a little bit more freedom. She has her own ladies' maid who is not, you know, snitching every minute. Like, I don't understand why Gladys is just kind of removed from the narrative. And was she in this episode at all?
I don't recall her being in the episode. Oh, not at all.
If she was not a major player. I don't remember seeing. I think the last time we saw her was at the Oscar Wilde play when she insulted Oscar Wilde. I mean, I don't blame her. That play was trash. But
so young and already a critic.
So I don't really know what she's up to. Also, have we seen Carrie Astor, like, period?
Yeah. We saw Carrie Astor early on
in episode one, right?
Yeah, when they were talking about, do you want to really be Mrs. Oscar Van Rhynes? And she was like, no. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's it. That's the only time we saw Carrie.
Yeah, you and I've talked extensively about how grateful we are that this show isn't entirely like a marriage plot show.
Yeah.
But I was expecting a little bit more marriage plot than this.
You want a little more. You're like, what's going on with Carrie Astor? Come on.
Right. I'm like, can I get some like young romance in here with my middle-aged romance? We can do both.
Kind of wild that the Van Rhynes and Astors wouldn't be plotting that Agnes wouldn't be like, all right, I'll help you out and hook your daughter up with my son. Like, kind of wild. I never thought about that. Like, that never even came up.
I feel like Agnes is smart enough to know that her son and Carrie Astor would not be a good idea.
Yeah.
Because he's so much older.
Yeah.
Right? Oscar's probably, like, what, in his 30s? Carrie Astor's, like, 17 or something.
That's a good point.
I think that she, even though that would be a totally legitimate marriage, I think she knows Oscar well enough to know that, like, that would not be a great match.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because she was never in on the Gladys thing. In fact, she probably would have opposed it. So I think she just knows her son well enough to know. There was some question this week I saw on the internet about whether or not she knows that her son is gay. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either. No. If it is later revealed that she does, I'm fine with it. I can live with it. I don't have strong feelings either way, but I don't think she knows.
I think people in the house know. I think Marion may suspect. I think Ada would not Ada would just like not would love him anyway and just like try to support him with his mom. So I don't think his mom or Ada know. That's my personal feeling.
I don't think Marion knows either, and I don't think I think it's pretty clear Aurora doesn't know. So I don't think anyone in his family knows. It just kind of highlights how sad that is for him, that his family never can really know him.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, 100%. I think what's the lady, the young girl in the downstairs? I think she kind of, I think like that scene where they're holding hands after he gets beat up, him and John Adams, I think she kind of like caught a glimpse. You know what I mean? Like that would be my feeling.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all if most of the downstairs staff knew.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. For sure, for sure.
You know, I don't know that Bannister knows, but it wouldn't surprise me at all if most of the downstairs staff knew, even if Peggy knew.
Yeah, 100%.
But I'm sort of glad that they haven't had that conversation on screen. Again, we talked about this in, I think, episode 2. I really don't want to spend the whole season focused on how miserable Oscar is. No. is a gay man, but I just was curious because I saw a lot of people asking about that on the internet this week, like what are our thoughts about Mrs. Van Ryan and her son, and does she really know him? Does she know him as a person? Like, that's important, you know?
Yeah, no, 100%. 110%. I don't know. I'm interested. Here's a question. Did you Google some things this week?
I Googled so much this week. Okay. This episode is packed with name dropping.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then there's just this, to full disclosure for our viewers, I had not intended to go down the rabbit hole with any of the name dropping. I actually was going to do an extensive thing on the Tuskegee School. I'm going to save that for next week. There was a lot in this episode that were things that happened that were contemporary to the time or happened during this year in New York City. But some of them are kind of silly and frivolous. Some of them are more important. But then I also realized when I was talking to someone about the show and how Booker T. Washington made an appearance, that not everyone really knows that much about him. So I thought it was important to kind of just like talk through who Booker T. Washington is. Mm-hmm. Just as some people haven't heard that name since high school, if they got it at all. So first thing up, since we had this Duke reception, and you just reminded me too that there was something I put a pin in from a previous episode that I wanted to touch about with the Duke's reception. And it will make sense with this, what we Googled for you. As they're walking into the reception, Mr. Russell says to his wife, like, we left behind these titles and stuff with the revolution. And it's just so funny to me. They're having this conversation, what do we call the Duke? And she says, Your Grace. And like, there's a whole thing in Downton Abbey about, mm-hmm. do you call them Your Grace to their face? Like all kinds of, anyway, all these like titles, right? But this is like a thing that America should have left behind. Like everybody's trying to get in the good graces of this Duke.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is so silly. This is not what this country is about at all. Like you guys are worshiping at the altar of some dude who inherited his wealth.
You'll be back. Just but- you see.
it's so silly. Like these are self-made people for the most part. Like the Wintertons, that seems like old money.
Yeah.
But like the Russells are self-made, and they're Mrs. Russell cannot wait to be in the good graces of some dude who inherited his title, his money, his standing in society from, you know, some ancient history.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, but meanwhile, they're like hostile to the Van Ryans, the Astors. Like, anyway, I just thought the whole thing, that whole construction. But when Turner is placed next to Oscar, she looks for her husband, and he's sitting next to this woman named Lily Langtry, mm-hmm. who was the mistress of one of the kings of England, Edward the VII. So I just thought it was important to like mention who she is. So she was born in 1853 in the Channel Islands. She married a wealthy landowner, Edward Langtry, in 1874, and they moved to London. And she was gorgeous and a socialite, and she soon decided to use that in her advantage and mm-hmm. started acting on the stage. She made her debut in 1881 at Haymarket Theatre in London. And people were just captivated with her. Like, she's a very, very well-known actress for the time. In fact, she was well-known in America as well. But beyond her acting career, she's actually best known for her relationship with the future king. He was the Prince of Wales at the time, Edward the VII. He is the grandfather to the king who abdicated. Yeah, just a little. Whenever in The Crown, they're like, your grandfather did this. That's who they're talking about.
I love that, like, we always be shouting out, yeah, you know, the one who abdicated. Like, that's like a mark time period. Like, we always throw this guy under the bus. It's amazing how many stories in which you get the opportunity to throw this guy under the bus. It's amazing. It's great.
Yeah. I mean, that was like one of the biggest events of the early, before the war.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it was like a major moment in what I guess back, like, now we would call pop culture history, because mm-hmm. like at the end of the day, did it really make like a global impact? But it was in every newspaper, right? This was a huge thing. This mm-hmm. Abdication is not taken lightly. I guess his grandpapa was a little bit better at keeping things discreet, or maybe people just didn't care, but it never got to that point for him. She was just like known for her, back to Lily, she was known for her independent spirit and flair. And she was just like kind of a symbol of elegance and beauty and what women aspired to be. She passed away in 1929 and left a legacy of being one of the most celebrated actresses and socialites of her era.
Wow. And I know you mentioned earlier about Jane Addams, who was born in 1860, was a pioneering American social worker, reformer, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate. She is best known for co-founding Hull House in Chicago in 1889, one of the first settlement houses in the United States. Hull House provided a range of services for urban poor, including education, healthcare, and cultural enrichment programs. Addams committed to social reform and advocacy for women's rights and labor rights made her a prominent figure in the progressive era. She was a leading voice in the suffrage movement and worked tirelessly for social justice, earning her the nickname the Mother of Social Work. Jane Addams' dedication to addressing the root causes of poverty and inequality left a lasting impact on American society, and her legacy continues to inspire those committed to social reform and humanitarian efforts today. She passed away in 1935, but her contributions to social work and activism remain influential to this day.
It's very interesting because I always thought of Abigail May Alcott, who was Louisa May Alcott's mother, as being mm-hmm. kind of the mother of social work. Mm-hmm. She was, these two probably ran in similar culture, circles. She was an abolitionist, she was a suffragist, like, she just, I always knew that she was someone who advanced social work, and she was one of the first paid social workers in America, period. So this was new for me. I knew Jane Addams was like the founder of settlement houses, mm-hmm. But I didn't realize that she was considered the mother of social work, so that was new information for me.
I love it. I love finding out these things. It's great when we like we said before when we did the segment, is because like we're constantly Googling like characters like while they're dropping names and talking during watching the episode. So it's really cool. It's really, really cool.
So very quickly, I just want to do a few biographical things about Booker T. Washington, who lived from 1856 to 1915. As is clear from the show, he was a prominent Black American educator, author, and a leader of sort of like the Black thought movement of the late 19th century and early 20th century. He was born into enslavement at Hales Ford, Virginia, and he became like a prominent figure in the Black community in challenging discrimination and segregation. Obviously, as the show has told us, he became the head of the Tuskegee Institute. It was initially called the Normal School for Negro Teachers. This is another thing I learned. I was not familiar with normal schools. They're basically teaching colleges. Mm. Apparently that normal school is still used in South America. But I'd never heard it before. I actually had to look it up. Mm. Under his leadership, it became a leading educational institution for Black Americans, but it emphasizes vocational and practical skills to promote economic self-sufficiency. He believed that having those skills and demonstrating economic success, that Black people would eventually gain social acceptance and civil rights. He gave the speech in 1895, which is probably what he's best known for, which advocated for Black folks to focus on vocational and industrial education and self-empowerment rather than directly challenging segregation. So, you know, obviously, like, the show is kind of playing that out in his conversation with Mr. Fortune. And his approach was criticized by a lot of people and is still criticized to this day. Like, one of the first things I learned about him was that, like, we shouldn't subscribe to his viewpoints because he thought that Black people could only gain civil rights through doing vocational stuff and that other types of education wasn't as valued. However, white philanthropists really liked his approach, and that's why he was successful. He was able to get the support of white philanthropists who helped build that dormitory that mm-hmm. Peggy and Mr. Fortune are there to cover, and build up the Tuskegee Institute to what it is essentially today. So while people didn't necessarily agree with his approach, it worked for the audience that he was pitching it at. So that's basically it. Like,
yeah, I mean, yeah, I know.
I just wanted to go through some of his basic biographical stuff since not everyone has the knowledge that we might have.
Yeah, and I know there was like a more, like, we had spoken about before, Du Bois as well, right? And I know that they had some differing opinions about that, where Du Bois was more like, no, we should, took a more confrontational approach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I wonder, I mean, I'm just going to play, like go on the opposite position for a second of what we've normally heard about, you know, Booker T. Washington. And I wonder sometimes, though, like, was the long game in his mind, like, to build up? Because if you think about what America's built on, it's built on industry and these industries that come from a lot of the vocational trades until they're automated, or until you have like the industrial, you know, like, we're in the Gilded Age, we're in the middle of like an industrial kind of like revolution. I wonder if he was thinking long game, like, hey, in order to actually make a confrontational challenge, you would need an economic base, and that would be a way to do it.
100%. I mean, yeah. I think he was, his whole approach was that gradually we will be a force to be reckoned with. But yeah. I think it all goes back, and maybe this is my own thing, I always go back to Maslow's hierarchy. Mm-hmm. If you don't have those basic needs met, you can't do any of the other stuff. And so I think he was making a point, like, we have to have the basic needs met, which is like, we need to be economically self-sufficient before we can start to, you know, demand other things. Again, I don't necessarily agree with it, but I understand what he was saying.
No, agree. Understood.
I do sometimes wonder what him and Du Bois would think about having a Black president. And I think you can kind of see, like, both of their contributions weaving throughout that as well. So it's interesting to consider. Like I said, I'd always, I grew up reading Du Bois. Like, it was one of the first books I took off my mother's bookshelf, and there was nonfiction. She had a lot of fiction too, but like that was, and that I didn't understand. I was reading some of his essays and I like did not understand them and had to have kind of deep conversations with my mom about what it meant. And in one of those essays, he directly takes a shot at Booker T. Washington, and I didn't have any context for Booker T. Washington. And so my mother explained Booker T. Washington's point of view and largely dismissed it, was just like, no, like it was too narrow, right? And so what I appreciate about this show is I had never taken the time, which is a failing of my own, to put myself in his shoes. And I still can't do that, right? I've never experienced bondage. So like, I can't do that as a person. But I like that this show puts it in this, like, what would it have been like for him living then, being a formerly enslaved person so close to the end of the Civil War? Like, this is a person who hasn't had their freedom that long. So... No. I definitely see his POV in a different light.
No, 100% agree. And I'd be interested in that perspective from a multiple different, like from the race, you know, the racial standpoint of we have a black president, and also just from the standpoint of the importance of the president. Because in this time period in the Gilded Age, there seems like the importance of the president is minimized to a certain degree. I don't know that, like, the president, from the things I've read, they're powerful for sure. Like, you know what I mean? But not as much as we look to them today. You know what I mean? Like, there was a different, like, self-reliance, I think. And the president was a person who wasn't just given a blank check in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Of like, you know? And I think, like, so it'd be pretty interesting to hear their people from this era, both, like, you know, the two people we're speaking about, but also like just even the people like, you know, the Van Ryns and the Russells and the, because, you know, there's a, in that same Gilded Age documentary I mentioned in the previous episode, there's also like a point where they talk about J.P. Morgan basically helping the president figure out a financial crisis and how people thought that he had bought the country. You know what I mean? Like, because of how much more industry and people we're pulling strings to keep America going than just one person in the presidency, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's really changed. I just think that we sometimes have a perception where we've almost given over more. We say we don't want kings and queens, but we've almost given too much credence to our elected officials. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So. Well, we're so happy you're with us. We are really, really zooming through this season. Already 4 episodes in, and thank you for listening. Hit us up, kinfolklore@gmail.com, kinfolklorepod on all our social media channels, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
Bye, everyone.